Okay, I think we're on. So, thanks a lot. We have Ellen Weiss with us today, just for the record, that's being recorded, and someone's going to be leading off the discussion. We're talking about power platform skills with the master himself, Ellen Weiss. So, Sima, take it away.
Okay. Alan, you've been speaking for a long time. I know you speak and consult and write. Today we're going to focus on the speaking aspect. What's the difference between a keynote speech, a plenary session, and a workshop?
Well, that's a really good question because it's mixed up all the time. Technically, a keynote sounds the key note for a convention, and that means that it's the first speech and it's to everyone. Now, there are two kinds of possible configurations in any kind of conference. One is everyone sitting in the same place hearing the same thing. That's called a plenary speech. So a keynote is a plenary speech. On the other hand of the conference, there can be other plenary speeches, which obviously are not the keynote. And the second kind of speech is called usually a concurrence or a breakout, meaning you're dealing with fewer than the entire people in the audience. You're dealing with 5 or 50 or whatever. But in this day and age, most speakers love to say they're keynote speakers, and so if they're giving a plenary speech, which is a speech to the whole house, no matter where it is in the conference, they call it a keynote. But if you think about it, it's kind of silly to think that any kind of conference could have more than one keynote. But that's just the way the language has sort of been bastardized today.
Okay, and what about workshop?
Well, a workshop or a seminar, if you like, is anything that could range from 90 minutes to days, and it's basically oriented toward the transfer of skills. So a workshop, as opposed to a keynote or a plenary session, is usually much more lengthy. So it's usually more than a 90-minute time frame. It's usually a morning or a whole day or several days. I mean, the Million Dollar Consulting College is 4.5 days. More toward the transfer of skills because there's opportunity to practice, there's opportunity for feedback, and so forth. Most speakers today who are making any kind of money are actually a workshop and seminar delivery people. There are very few of us really these days who could make a living strictly as a keynoter outside of celebrities. But in the non-celebrity world, most people making money as speakers are trainers. And they're doing workshops and they're doing seminars, and that's noble work. I mean, I got out of it a long time ago because it drove me crazy. But it's noble work, and that's where most of the money is today.
Mm. Now, are there different kinds? I know plenary and talk about plenary and keynote. Are there different kinds of plenaries or different kinds of keynotes? I know you talked earlier about interactive keynotes.
Well, not really. I mean, there's a difference in terms of how people might conduct them. For example, more than half the time when I'm doing a keynote, if the conditions permit, I will still have audience participation. Sometimes the conditions don't permit, but I've done that with 1,000 people in front of me. So it really depends on the style and the nature of the person doing the delivery. But, that's a matter of taste and style and conditions and what you choose to do.
How do you prepare for speaking? If you're going to do a program, how do you prepare?
Well, how do I answer that?
Would you tell us a little bit about your process?
Excuse me, when I speak, about 60% of what I say is roughly the same, because no matter to whom I am speaking, I'm talking about innovation, I'm talking about behavior change, I'm talking about performance, I'm talking about empowerment. Those are the things that constitute my intellectual property, my expertise, and so I'm always going to talk about them. Now, the other 30%, or another 30%, is oriented more toward the audience and the environment. So if I'm with a bank, or an insurance company, or a chemical firm, or a transportation company, or whatever, I'm going to adjust my speaking to relate the examples and the metaphors and the analogies to their kind of environment. So 30% will be sort of oriented. People talk about customization and things like that. I think it's far too grand a word. And most speakers customize by simply changing the title, in all candor. The final 10% is I just do what's on my mind that moment. I ad-lib. It might be something I just saw in the Wall Street Journal or a discussion I have. I do this all the time, a discussion I have at a table before I'm actually introduced. And so 10% I'll ad-lib. So that's what I do. So my preparation for a speech is basically, if you take this from ground zero, so to speak, I might talk to the buyer. I might speak to one or two other people on the board or something. I'll orient what I want to do, and then that's it. I don't practice. I don't go through any kind of machinations. I just go out and deliver it. Now, I have to tell you that there's a very big name speaker whose name I won't mention here, although he said this publicly many times, and he essentially gives the same speech every time. He's been doing it for 40 years, and it's the same speech. And he says that before every appearance, he practices 2 hours for every 1 hour of his talk. So his speech is 2 hours. He practices 4 hours every time he delivers it, yet it's the same speech. He calls that careful preparation. You know, I call that a learning disability. So, I mean, this is just not rocket science. And the fact is that if you're good at what you do, people say, you know, I'll answer a question, you didn't ask me similar, but people ask me all the time, do you get butterflies? Do you get nervous? I never get nervous. I get anticipatory, though. I love what I'm doing. When I stop, I won't do it anymore. But I love what I'm doing. So I can't wait to get out there. What drives me crazy is somebody doing something up there before I'm introduced that goes on forever, which is unnecessary, or some introducer who doesn't follow my instructions and just read my introduction verbatim and instead decides to do a magic act or, you know, or show slides of his last vacation. That kind of stuff drives me crazy. But I do like to get out there and do my thing. And then when I'm done, I leave.
Now, a lot of people in the SAC mentor forum are consultants, and some people are more newer to speaking than others. So if just talking to somebody who's newer and they were asked to do a speech on maybe something that they consult on that they asked to do a speech and they haven't given them one before, how do you suggest they should prepare?
Well, if you're preparing, it depends. If you're preparing a keynote speech or a short speech, let's say it's up to 90 minutes, okay?
Yes.
If you're preparing that, then what you want to do is look at the speech as having three components. There's an opening, there's a body, and there's a close. And this is what we talk about, for example, in my program, Speaking with Alan, and things like that. This is how you can systematically and sort of formulaically create a speech. So let's just look at them real briefly. The opening should be about 2 minutes or less. It happens, obviously, when you first walk out there. And as a new speaker, what you have to remember is this. When you walk out there, the audience is vesting you with credibility. That is, they're on your side. They're not against you. And unless you have some personality disorders in the audience, you know, which might be 5% of the group, most people want to see a success. And so, you know, nobody wants to go home and say, oh, I had a great morning. The speaker bombed. It was glorious. You know, I wasted my time. I loved it. People want to be part of a success. They want to laugh. They want to learn. They want to be compelled and treated and so on. And so when you walk out there, the idea is not to lose that credibility. So your opening, your first 90 seconds or 2 minutes, will help people determine how closely they want to listen to the next part of your speech. So it's vital that you open with something that is a hook. Now, the hook might be an example. It might be a story. It might be humor. It might be a demonstration. It might be statistics that are in the paper that morning. Who knows? But you've got to catch people and get them fascinated with what you're about to say so they listen to the second part. And the second part of the speech is the body. And depending upon the length of your speech, you might have 5 or 6 or 8 parts here, 8 points. If you're a new speaker, you might actually want to enumerate them. And you might say, I have 8 points I want to share with you. People can follow along. If you're a more veteran speaker, you can just say the next point is, and then you summarize it. I've just given you 6 points. And each of those points surrounding your topic should have an example, should have some kind of support for your position. This is not like a term paper. You don't have to give statistics. You don't have to give footnotes. You don't have to show how, you know, scientifically you're right. But you do have to give people anecdotal evidence of why what you're saying is probably true. And the more examples you use, the more they can relate to it. And then finally, the close of the speech is, again, just 2 or 3 minutes. And the close is a call to action. And you want to say, these are the 6 points I discussed. Here's what I would expect you to do tomorrow to put this in motion. And then you close with something that's memorable. I tend to close with a story, but you can close with a summary, with a list, with a rhetorical question, whatever you want to do. So opening, body, close. That's what a speech looks like, whether it's 45 minutes, 60, 90 minutes. That's what you do. If you're talking about longer workshops and so forth, then you have to actually build in class exercises.
Well, one question that somebody sent me was, is it okay to use notes, or should you try to just memorize everything?
You're silly to memorize anything, because that's not what you're being paid for. Nobody's paying you to memorize a speech. And so consequently, what you need to do is to use notes that are not, let's say, obnoxious, but nonetheless, you make sure you get where you want to go. So I tend to use a podium where I put bullet points. And the bullet points ensure that I don't miss anything, but that I can still talk conversationally because I don't have anything scripted. After all, I'm there to convey value to the audience, not to memorize, and so I don't want to miss some of my key points. Moreover, sometimes I don't want to riff. Somebody asks me a question or I think of something on that living, I want to go back and see what points I might have missed during my little riff. I do that quite frequently. Sometimes there'll be a teleprompter. You can actually watch a screen and your speech can scroll, and you can use that. Some people, when they're using visual aids, some people use PowerPoints or other kinds of visual aids, they actually use that as their outline. And so never memorize a speech. It doesn't serve anyone any good at all, including yourself. It's worthless. But what you should be is very comfortable with the points you want to make, and you should walk out that first 2 minutes, the opening. That should be something you deliver quite casually, conversationally, in the middle of the stage.
Okay. Question from Pat Tice. She can't be here today. Is how do you develop a keynote quickly?
Well, she can't be here. I'm not answering.
Okay.
How do you deliver?
But other people have asked the same question.
How do you deliver a keynote quickly?
Yes.
Well, you do what I just said. I mean, you take your something of value, whatever your point is, how to accelerate sales and minimize cost of acquisition, how to stop creating teams when none exist, or some whatever it is, and you look for the key points you want to make, the 3 or 4 or 5 points, and you organize around that. I mean, it's very simple. And the important thing is you need to tell people what they need to know, but not everything you know. And too many speakers, and this is why you see people going overtime all the time, by the way. The most famous case was a guy, a professor who was in, of course, professors are hopeless in any case. They don't know how to present. They don't know really what to do except to actually stay off the streets and stay away from, moving cars. But he showed up for a 20-minute engagement with 110 slides. I mean, what's he thinking? And so when you see people go over, it's because they're trying to tell people everything they know. And there's no need to do that. There's only a need to tell them what they need to know.
Is there a way of knowing if you're connecting with your audience, and if you're not connecting with your audience, what can you do?
Well, I would think that if you're going to do Q&A, that's an immediate way to know if you're connecting with your audience because you'll get spontaneous questions. However, if you have aspects of your talk where you're expecting people to laugh, you're expecting people to go, you're expecting people to argue, you're expecting people to engage in an exercise with each other, you ask for feedback, and you get it or don't, those are all indications of whether people are with you or not. Now, in a smaller group, you can tell very easily. You can tell by the eye contact, you can tell by the body language, you can tell whether there's energy in the room. In a larger group, it's harder to tell. Now, usually, a rule of thumb is this. The larger the group, the more you will get energy from the group, because the larger the group that people are in, the more they feel free to volunteer, the more they feel free to laugh, the more they feel free to engage in whatever exercise you give them. So the larger the group, there is safety in numbers, and people will react better. However, the smaller the group, the tougher it is to get a volunteer, the tougher it is to get a laugh, and if you have a hierarchical group, where you have a small group and some people are clearly superior to others in the hierarchy, the subordinates will wait to see what the superiors do. So a small group is more difficult than a large group.
So how would you deal with it if you knew that you were talking to a group, but it seemed like they weren't engaged? What would you do if you were giving, say, an hour plenary? What would you do to engage them if you felt you were losing them?
Well, a good thing to do is to give them an exercise to do together. And you should always have these in reserve. So let's say that you don't feel you're getting, give me a point. Let's say you're talking about inclusion symbol, which is something you talk about. And let's say that what you find is that you just don't feel the energy from the group there. What you do is you say, look, I'm going to give you a little inclusion exercise. And you pull this out of your kit and you say, how many times in the past month have you done this? How many times in the past year have you visited with that? What is your idea of how you'd respond to this? And then you tell people to exchange that information with each other, to share it with each other. And that way you get some energy moving in the room, you get some action. So any kind of exercise like that is really helpful. You give people a contest, give people a challenge, and they respond well. I do this little thing with a Japanese fishing boat. I ask people to come. I make them all consultants. and I ask them to come up with recommendations as to how they would solve the problem. And that gets people really cooking. They just turn to four or five people around them. Then I just shout out and get recommendations from the floor. It's a great, great exercise. So you should always have things like that in your kit, so to speak, to do.
Okay. What was the most challenging thing you had to deal with while you were speaking to a group? And how did you deal with it personally?
Well, actually, that comes to mind immediately. I was asked to speak for Nissan, and it was an after-dinner speech, and so the circumstances were these. During the day, it was the first day of their conference. It was a three-day conference, and the first day, they had a series of long seminars. So people showed up at 8 or 9 in the morning, and they did nothing but attend seminars until about 5 o'clock. It was wearying. And then they had an open bar. And after the open bar, they went into dinner. And at the dinner, they had flowing wine. They kept pouring wine. And don't worry, I'm supposed to speak for an hour after the dinner. Well, near the end of the dinner, when everybody's already pretty drunk, the three Nissan executives from Tokyo got on stage who could not speak English, and they had an interpreter. And they each gave a very short speech, about 2 minutes, but then at the end they yelled banzai, and the interpreter explained when they yelled banzai, everybody was to chug their glass of sake. And so the wait staff came around and filled these glasses of sake, and they said banzai, and the sake had to go down in one gulp. Well, by the end of the third guy, they had these three glasses of sake on top of the wine, on top of the open bar, and people were roaring drunk. And I grabbed the coordinator who came by. I actually grabbed him by his tie. I still remember his name was Tom. I grabbed him by his tie as he was swept by, and I said, Tom, I'm doing 20 minutes or less. I'm going to hit just a couple of points, and then I'm leaving. Do you understand me? And he said, yeah. And I got up there, and I shouted something at them. Just to get their attention. And I told them there were four things I had to think about tomorrow, and it was a good idea to learn them while they were drunk, because it was probably a lot better than when they were sober. And everybody listened. I screamed the four things at them, and then I had smuggled up, nobody saw, a glass of sake, because I never drink when I work. And after I was done, and this took about 12 minutes, I held up the glass of sake, and I screamed at them, banzai, and as everybody drank, I left.
And how was it received?
It was received wonderfully. I get paid in advance. And there was not, everybody was so drunk, what could they have said? There was nothing else to do. The other thing I would mention to you, one of the highlights of my very early career, and this is on tape in a couple of places, Merck was a big client of mine for many years, and I was asked to kick off their Western Canadian Sales Conference. I was somewhere, I don't know where, in Calgary, I guess, Vancouver, and they had the entire Western Canadian sales force there. There must have been 400 people, and they were giving out awards, and they had a wine flowing all night, which was, the wine was labeled with Merck drugs. So instead of being called, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon, it was called Mevacor, you know. And then they thought this was hysterical. So they all got drunk. And so I was speaking after the award ceremony. So it was after drinking, after dinner, after the award ceremony. And the vice president of Canada, Bob, got up there, who later became CEO of Glaxo Pharmaceuticals, a guy named Bob Ingram. He introduced me, and he said, Alan Weiss has been working with Merck for a long time. He's a consultant, he says. And we all know what a consultant is. He's someone who knows 40 ways to make love and doesn't know any women. And he says, ladies and gentlemen, Alan Weiss. And I walk up there, and all 800 drunk eyes are on me, half hysterical over this introduction. And I know in the next 5 seconds, I am going to win them over or lose them. It's very existential. And I said at the mic, well, I guess the first thing I should do is introduce myself to the women in the audience. The place went absolutely crazy, and after that I was golden. But you have to stay in the moment. You absolutely have to be in the moment. And when you speak, that's why I say 10% of my stuff is ad-lib, you can't be so scripted or choreographed or orchestrated that you lose the moment, because that's what makes the difference between being good and being great.
Okay. Well, now I'm going to open it up to questions from people who are on the call. So who's got the first question?
Alan, this is Linda Popke. One of the things that you talked about, you know, how you take the temperature of the audience and kind of see what they're doing. What happens when you start down a short presentation and you see that you're losing them? How do you get out of that, or how do you get back if you don't happen to have the glass of sake?
Well, I think Sim alluded to this before. If you see you're not with them, you have to make a determination, Linda, about whether it's you or whether it's conditions. For example, I actually spoke once, you can't make this stuff up, where the first thing that happened in the morning, unbeknownst to me, no one had told me, was they held a brief memorial service for a very valued employee who had passed away. And so that just put a pallor, you know, over everything. Sometimes you find that you've shown up, and unbeknownst to you, in the last day or 2 days, they've announced a layoff, or something critical has happened to affect people. So if that's the thing, you have to actually change what you're doing and address what's on their mind, because otherwise they're not going to pay you any attention. And so what you have to say is something like, look, I understand what's happened here. And my talk today is about empowerment. And what I'd like to talk to you about is what happens, how do you empower yourself when you feel guilty because valued colleagues are now gone? And so that's what we're going to do. And I would actually orient it on the fly toward that. Now, if that's not it, though, and it's about you, and there's something you've done, it's your topic, you know, who knows what, then I would go into criticize. And I would stimulate questions. And you can always, you know, the bigger the group, the easier it is to do this. But give them an exercise, stimulate some questions, and get a feel for what's hot on their minds. One of the reasons that I don't prepare a lot in advance, that is, I don't rehearse and all that, but I do get there, when I get there about a half an hour early, I talk to people at tables who don't know who I am. I'll sit down and I'll just chat. I never tell people I never, ever wear ID. They're always giving me these tags and labels and necklaces. I never wear anything. Which upsets a lot of them, but I don't really care. And I'll just talk, and I will often use something I've learned right on the spot. I did a session once for the United States Society of Radiologists, and what I found was two interesting things as I was at the table. One is that these radiologists are having a fit because they wanted to become managers and run radiology businesses, but instead they actually have to do the grunt work because it's so hard to get people to work for them. The second thing is that a guy told me a really funny story about being in the business and dealing with this tremendously fat guy who came in. And, he said he had no way of knowing, but his first patient was, morbidly obese, he said. He was about 400 pounds or so. And he said, but he treated him professionally, as he should. He had never met him before. And but the guy was hard to move around, you know, as you'd have to x-ray and draw lines or whatever they do on these people. And at one point, trying to move around the table, the guy fell, he lost his balance, and he fell on top of the radiologist. And the radiologist couldn't move, and the guy got so perturbed, he was so upset at what had happened, that he was borborygmic. He passed there. And so the radiologist is telling me at the table that he's trapped into this 400-pound man, and now there's this awful, awful smell. And so he starts screaming. And as he's screaming, the office assistant comes tearing in. And the office assistant's first words were, "Uncle Louie, what are you doing on top of the radiologist?" And so I asked his permission, and I told this story. And before you knew it, all these radiologists were coming out with their own horror stories. Who could have thunk, you know? There was all this radiological humor. So sometimes you just have to go with that kind of stuff.
Okay, thanks. Okay, next. Who's next?
This is Willow. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Willow.
Yeah.
All right. So what's your position on platform skills versus content, and what do you recommend people have as minimal platform skills before getting on stage and delivering presentations and so on?
Well, I'm going to try to answer that question. First of all, obviously they're both important. You have to have sizzle and steak. I think some of the problems, for example, you find in the National Speakers Association is they put too much emphasis on platform skills and not nearly as much on content. And that's why, you know, Pat Fripp and I started The Odd Couple all those years ago. So I would say that, and you know, people have said I brought her over to the dark side. I would tell you the following. You have to have solid, solid content. You have to be able to give people more than empty platitudes like, you know, be your own best friend. You have to tell people that, listen, one of the reasons you're having trouble with relationships is that you're considering baggage that you've been carrying around for all these years. Here's how you can rid yourself of it. So there has to be pragmatic help. In terms of the minimum that you would need on stage, you have to know how to work with a variety of different microphones and lighting. Are you going to have a follow spot? If so, what are the limits that you can travel? Are you going to have regular sort of proscenium lighting? Will there be no lighting? Are you going to have a wireless lapel? Are you going to have a headset? Are you going to have a handheld mic? Will it be wireless or have a wire? You have to know how to work with all of these. And because sometimes you'll request a wireless lapel, but it won't work. And they'll hand you a handheld wired mic, which is a very different sort of kinesthetic movement on stage, and you have to be ready to use it. You can't say, I've never used this before. You have to be able to know how to deal with a small group by looking them in the eye, and with a large group, often which you can't see because the follow spot will really blind you to the audience, to look to certain areas in the room, and you do that by familiarizing yourself with the room before you walk out. And so as long as you can move around the stage and use hand gestures, those are sufficient platform skills. I don't mean to make that easier than it sounds, but it is that easy. You have to be able to walk and talk. And I remember doing a speech for a small business award ceremony here in Providence, which was sponsored by three large companies. And there were, you know, several hundred people, and I don't know, a dozen people got these small business awards. I was the after dinner speaker, and 3 minutes, and told them all that kind of stuff. But anyway, at the end, when I'm, you know, walking off stage and the thing is breaking up, and of course people come up to talk to you, a woman says to me, "You're the greatest speaker we've ever had here. You've been doing this for 12 years. You're the greatest speaker." I said, yeah, come on. Because, I won't let people say that they can help me improve my speech. I don't also have any tolerance when people tell me I'm the greatest speaker they've ever heard. And she says, no, there's been nobody better. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what. Tell me why I'm the best. Give me the evidence. Give me the behavioral evidence. And she said, it's simple. You were able to walk and talk and hold that microphone as you crossed the stage all at the same time. I said to her, what about my 4 points for small business? She said, what 4 points? And so sometimes just being able to conduct yourself normally up there is sufficient. So platform skills are not that difficult. I remember once I spoke for a group in California, and I was the last speaker of the day. I was the sort of the plenary session close. And I'm standing by the door. No one knows who I am, and I'm watching people walk in. And the room was darkened with sufficient lighting to see your seat, and the stage was set. And there was some soft music playing, and one guy says to another, you see, this guy is a professional speaker. And so, you know, anytime you follow, for example, an executive, you're going to look very, very good. So you need very minimal platform skills, but you need very good content, and you need excellent grasp of the language so you can deliver the content with humor, with a compelling interest to learn more, and things like that.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, I have another question, Alan. Oh, go ahead. Who had a question?
Well, if nobody's going, I have another one.
Please.
Alan, you've been known to never use PowerPoint or electronic devices to when you deliver your workshops and when you deliver your keynotes. Why do you not use electronic devices such as PowerPoint so often? And can you tell us why an easel and sheets are so much more important and useful?
What was the last thing you said? What is more useful?
The easel and the sheets.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, what you said is not quite true. I never use PowerPoint for keynotes. Because I never use visuals for keynotes because it's completely inappropriate. In a keynote speech, you want the emphasis on you. And anytime you have a large visuals up there, you become subordinate to the technology. And so in a keynote speech, I never ever use visuals. I mean, you know, rare exception. But I'm just wandering the stage. Now, in longer talks, though, I almost always use visuals. I mean, that's not quite an accurate wrap on me. I used to use overhead slides, and now I use PowerPoint more and more frequently because I feel that for the first time you can use PowerPoint without a lot of glitches. I used to see every PowerPoint presentation crash. So in the Million Dollar Consulting College, where I used overheads for, you know, the first 10, for this last one, the 11th or 12th, whatever it was, I used PowerPoint slides all week. If I'm doing a full day, I use PowerPoint. So when I did a full day in Sydney a few months ago for 500 people, I was on from 9 to 12 and 1 to 4, and so we used PowerPoint. It was projected on the screens by these, these IMAX kind of things. I had a teleprompter on the floor so I could see the slides were up there. I was careful that there was no projection behind me. You never want projection behind you. And so I will use visuals when I'm on longer and I'm transferring skills, and the visuals are helpful to transfer the skills. I just don't use them in a keynote. And as far as easel sheets are concerned, I love to use easel sheets with small groups because I can put up process visuals on the spur of the moment based upon what the group says. You see, the disadvantage of any kind of prepared visual is that it comes in a certain order, it's there already created, and something comes up in class that suddenly is not in your outline or not in your prepared remarks, but something you want to address because it's great, then you can't beat an easel in an easel sheet. And so even in Australia, I was able to do that because the camera would just focus in on the easel sheet and everybody, 500 people could see it. So that's how I use those kinds of things.
Excellent. Thank you.
How do you decide what content you're going to use? I mean, there's so much. So how do you decide when you're preparing what you're going to include in terms of content?
Well, like I said, 60% of the speech, I know what it's going to be because there are several factors I always have in. For the rest of it, I'm going to adjust for that client. So what I'm going to think about some are things like this. What are the buyer's specific objectives for this speech? What does he want people to walk out with? What are the current environmental conditions? What are the current societal conditions? What are the current economic conditions? And what are the current technological conditions? Those are the four variables I tend to look at anytime I get in front of a group. And some of them might not be relevant, or some of them might not be changing, but some of them might be. And that's how I prepare, you know, what I've gotten there. But don't forget, you know, I have a wealth, I have a repository of things, you know, in my head, of these file cards in my head, where I can respond to really anything that comes up with an example, with a metaphor, with a process visual, and that's what keeps a speech really alive, and that's why I'm saying you need to be in the moment. And I can recall seeing a lot of speeches where it was going quite well until somebody asked a particular question, and it really threw the presenter off. You know, there are some big names in NSA who pride themselves on being keynote speakers, but they never take questions. And when they do take a question, the question can ruin their day. I mean, they really have to go back to the beginning and start all over again because, you know, at 14 minutes and 12 seconds in, they're saying the same thing every time. They expect people to laugh at a certain cue, cry at a certain cue. That's not really speaking. That's some kind of performance art. So, I want to be in the moment, and I want to be able to present something that's relevant in the moment to the people I'm talking to. I mean, I remember doing a speech for a technological group, and I was the second guy on. The first guy was doing some kind of update of where they were, and then I was the keynote speaker. And I'm sitting in the audience with a few hundred people, and up on the screen is a screenshot of something. I couldn't even begin to understand. Some kind of spreadsheet. And, you know, he was using words like advanced, discounted, collateral, you know, preemption of something. And people applauded it. And I walked out there, and the first thing I said was, I just heard you applaud a scream that I couldn't even comprehend. I'm not sure how much I have to say to you. And everybody broke up laughing, you know. Those things happen. And so I think that that's just grist for the mill. Those are great things to run with.
That's funny. Hey, Alan, this is John Levington. A quick question. It might sound kind of contradictory, but you're very good at ad-libbing. And I've seen a lot of the speakers just really kind of fall down as they try to ad-lib. Is there anything that you can prepare yourself to be good at ad-libbing?
That's kind of actually more on it, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do you prepare to ad-lib? Well, look, your question's not so far-fetched. If you want to ad-lib, whether it's humor, or it's a story, or it's, you know, just a riff you go on, you have to have a couple of things in your possession. One thing is, you have to have intellectual breath. That is, you have to be able to talk about things extemporaneously. And, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find something I couldn't talk about extemporaneously. And so, you have to be well-read. You have to be up to date in terms of your business acumen, in terms of what's going on in the world. And you have to have a great command of the language so you can use the kind of examples and metaphors you need to use. And the second thing is you have to have tremendous confidence and understand that you have to have almost a third ear. I would liken it to a musician. You ever see, you know, people who sing or play an instrument in a concert, in a large setting, they always have these, they used to have speakers right in front of them, but these days now they have earpieces in. And what the earpieces help them do is understand the actual sound of their voice or their instrument. because otherwise it gets lost, and I can't adjust the tonality. And so, I liken it to adjusting your own tonality. I want to be able to hear what I'm saying, so I know whether it's ringing true, whether it's answering a question, whether it's adding value, even though it's a digression, and because then you have to know when to come back again. And so with a small group, you can say things like, is this useful? Should I go on? Is this valuable? A lot of you have been in the Million Dollar Consulting College or my other programs have heard me ask the audience that all the time. You know, is this valuable where I'm going? But with a large group, you can't do that. And so you have to listen to your own voice, listen to your own riff, and understand whether it's valuable. But the more well-rounded you are, the better read, the better command you have of the language, the easier it is to ad lib. And if you have a sense of humor, and you can work in subtle humor to what you do, that's the real key. I'm not talking about telling jokes. I'm just talking about creating the right perspective.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Hi, Alan. This is Stuart.
Hey, Stuart.
Alan, in your career, did you see yourself as a really good speaker immediately, or was it a slow development curve or a fast development curve?
I'll tell you something really weird. When I joined a firm in Princeton called Captain Atrigo in 1972, the first thing they did was put you to a two-week training and tanker program, the same thing they put their own clients through, but as an employee, you went through it too. So I went through it with a guy named Mitch. He was the instructor. And it's a two-week intensive train-the-trainer program. And I said to myself, and you were learning to teach one-week courses. And I said to myself, I might be able to teach this one-week course, but I can never do what Mitch is doing. I can't see how he does this. It's just astounding, the how adept he is, the agility he has in doing this. And I went out and started teaching one-week courses, and I was very nervous. I mean, I wouldn't sleep the night before. Because you'd have a group of business people in front of you. I was 26 years old. I was teaching them problem-solving, decision-making. And, you know, you had an outline and you had exercises, but you had to do with questions and you had to explain things. And some of the concepts were intricate to explain. Well, as I kept doing that, and, you know, I forced myself to do it as part of the job. I didn't run away from it. I got better at it. And guess what? I wound up running the two-week train-the-trainer programs. And then I became the preeminent guy in the company running these. I would do one a quarter, even when I was a vice president, which was unheard of. I would still do one a quarter, and people would fight, I mean, clients and so forth, just to get into my programs. And I was probably the best training the trainer guy in the country, in the United States of America at the time. If you looked in all of the training company, you know, Wilson Learning and Forum and all these places, in the late 70s, I was the best training the trainer guy in the country, and I did these two-week intensive programs. Coming out of that, you can do anything. And so, you know, in the early 80s, when I was fired in 85 from the job I have here, in 1985, when I went out to market myself, I would speak just to market myself. I mean, I was speaking for free, or I was speaking for my fee, if anybody asked, by the way, was $750. And if somebody gave me $750 for what I thought was free marketing, you know, I just thought I had died and gone to heaven. And then I got a call from a firm in Connecticut. It was a Fortune 500 company at the time. The name GTE, and GTE had dealt with a guy named Victor Vroom, who some of you heard me talk about. He's a Yale professor. He did a seminal work on decision making with a guy named Phil Yetton, who's an Australian. And I met Victor Vroom at this firm in Princeton and learned to teach his stuff. Well. Now I'm out on my own, and it turns out that he's got a contract with GTE, but he's going to be overseas. And GTE says, we can't cancel a program. And Victor Vroom says to him, the only other guy who can teach us really well is Alan Weiss. You know, I don't know where he is these days. We've got to track him down. So they track me down. And GTE says, look, Victor Vroom can't do this. He says, you're the guy. We desperately need you to come up here. So they said, what'd you see? And I said, Jesus, you know, GTE, I'm not going to charge GTE $750. And so I said, I don't know where it came from. Now, this is 1985. I said, $2,000. And I just held my breath. And they said, okay, fine. And they said, now, we'd like to meet you. We just feel it's important to meet you. So, you know, I was in New Jersey. They were in Connecticut. It was about a two-hour car drive. They said, could you come up a few weeks before so we can meet you, shake your hand, get to know you, show you the place? So I said, well, that will cost more. They said, well, we expected that. How much more? I said, $500. They said, done. So I hung up the phone, and my wife came by and said, you look pale. What's wrong? I said, I just made $2,500 in 7 minutes. And she said, maybe being on your own isn't so bad. So I had gone from the scared kid to somebody who was recommended by one of the top researchers in the world. You know, Fick is retired today, but he's still around. And then I realized, then I, so in 1986, I'm sorry, Stuart, for this long-winded answer, but I want to,
I'm still listening.
In 1986, right, so this is 85. In 86, I decide, well, if I'm going to be a speaker for money, I mean, I'm not going to charge people $2,500, for God's sake, I better find out what I'm doing. So I joined the National Speakers Association, and I go to my very first meeting. I took a look around. I went home, and I immediately doubled my rates. And I realized that I was already better than most of these people. I mean, it was an eye-opener. People said, NSA really helped you, didn't it? I said, you don't know how. And I went home, and so now he's a $5,000 speaker. I said, you know, my God, this is the cream of the crop, you know? And my rates just went steadily upwards. So it's interesting what you learn, and it's interesting. The last thing I'll say to you is this. As my rates went up, and as people expected that they were getting a top guy, you could do almost anything. And unless you had a really skeptical group, a group that didn't want to be there, they just wanted to hear Alan Weiss. And, you know, I would come out sometimes and say something, people start laughing. And I would say that wasn't a laugh line, you know? But I remember doing the series for Century 21, the real estate people, and I did this thing for some of their top award winners, and they loved it. They had me come back 5 times because they have people who are award winners in residential sales and office sales and so on. They have 5 different categories. Well, to my horror, in the second group, there was about a 10% overlap. In the third group, there's about a 20% overlap. So by the time I'm in the fourth and fifth group, I'm dying for material because, you know, it's now an 80, 90% overlap. And I remember in one of these latter sessions, somebody stops me with about 15 minutes to go and says, aren't you going to tell the immigration story? And I said, I recognize you. You've heard it. He said, yeah, yeah, but we love that story. And then I went, aha! People want to hear the stories again. And so that's a completely different level you're at that point.
Mm-hmm. Hi, it's Lisa Bing.
Only 45 minutes late.
It's snowing. Sorry.
So what's your question? Stuart, was that all right?
That was great, Alan. Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.
Somebody has something. Oh, I thought I did. So, Alan, you know, that was a terrific story, right? I mean, is there a trick for getting a story that, you know, interesting, and what, and how long should you do it? I remember when I was speaking in Alan, and the very few, you know, you talked about openings, and I gave my opening for the first time. I remember the first thing you said to me was, first of all, that story is way too long.
Yeah, right.
So what, I mean, how do you know when, you know, how long to tell a story? Because I've heard some long, you tell some long stories, but they're good stories. And so, you know, you keep the listener or the audience member really engaged with their stories for a while. And how do you do that? Is there a way to explain how that happens?
Well, the longest story I tell, which is one of my sailing stories, is 8 minutes. And that's the longest story I tell. And it is difficult to tell an 8-minute story. You have to have, I mean, I'm just going to say this as honestly as I can. You have to have superb skills to tell an 8-minute story and keep people involved. And so what I advise people is stories should generally be about 2 minutes, especially an opening story. An opening story should really be a quick hitter because you want to get people with you quickly, you want to move on, and you don't want to just go on and on forever. So your opening story should be brief. Most of your stories should be brief. 2 minutes is a really good target. Now, you know, if it's 3 minutes, fine. 1 minute is fine. The key is that, you know, does the audience get something out of it? Are you moving the conversation forward? And what you want to do with a story is, if you notice, all of my stories are personal. All of my stories are absolutely true. And I only modify my stories for cadence, for timing and cadence. And once I've done that, I never touch them again. So when I tell the immigration story, you know, when I first started telling my immigration story, which was based on a true incident of my going to Quebec City, I told it 2 or 3 times, to experiment with it. And I told it to nonprofit groups and previews I was doing. And then when I realized what it was, it never changes. Because, first of all, I believe in success, not perfection, and I don't like to futz around. But secondly, once you get the cadence and the timing, you know, it's really difficult to do better, and you're not going to do any better where the audience is going to get more out of it. So then the story just stays the same forever. You have to be able to deliver a story without looking at your notes. I mean, a story's got to be something you deliver conversationally. It can't appear to be memorized. It's got to be conversationally delivered, timing is everything. You have to know when to pause. You have to know what words to accentuate. You have to know how to end it. all those things become very important. But you can do that through practice. And I always practice my material at freebies. And so when I do these chapters, you know, four or five chapters that ask me to speak over the next year, I will test new material there.
Is there any science to knowing when to pause, how long to pause? I hate to get like that specific into things, but I've heard some very boring stories told by speakers and good ones, and I can't for myself decipher the science behind that. Is there a science behind that, or is it just something you just feel, or do you get feedback from the audience?
It's an art form. It's not science. It's just like saying, is there a science to acting? I mean, some actors are method actors, but it's really an art form. And the art form is you have to know, you have to feel when the story's right and when you want to make your points. Now, the important thing to me is this. There are audience-centered speakers and there are speaker-centered speakers. And speaker-centered speakers want to tell a story for their own enjoyment. They want to tell a story to get laughs. They want to tell a story to get high ratings. They want to tell a story because they want to brag. You know, I've had my fill of people bragging on stage. But an audience-centered speaker will tell a story that might reflect very well on them and so forth, although most of my stories are derogatory. You know, they're stories that where I'm in the tough position because I want the audience to relate to that. But the audience-centered speaker will tell a story where the audience hears it in a brief but effective manner. That's why you have a director at a play. The director is sitting in the audience trying to understand how the audience will accept the lines that are being said, the movement, the blocking that's done with the actors. I was at a play the other day where I think the director completely blew it because he didn't really put himself, he was too busy interpreting the playwright's words and not trying to decide how the audience would receive them. So you have to put yourself in that position of the audience, and that's why it's always good to record what you do. Even if you don't want to make a product, even if you don't want to make a demo, even if it's just audio, it's always good to record what you do, because only by playing that back can you really tell what your timing was like, what your speed was like, what your volume was like, and that's a very that's high fidelity. That's a very good way to do it.
Thanks a lot, Alan.
Sure.
Alan, it's Lisa.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you decide the story is worth keeping?
Well, there's just a couple of questions. First, you have to make sure it suits your purpose, and it gets across the point you want to make. But the second is, how does the audience respond? If it's a funny story, do they laugh? If it's a thoughtful story, do they ask questions? If it's a story you want to refer to later, does it serve that purpose where you can refer back to it and people remember it? And so you keep stories that work in terms of what the objective for the story might be. You jettison stories that don't fill those goals or that no longer have a timely reference. I mean, if you're talking about a vacuum tube, you might have some problems there.
Right.
Depending. If you're talking about, a mode of transportation that isn't used anymore or a show on TV that people haven't seen for 20 years, you might have some problems with that.
Right. I think what I really was getting at is when you have, because you mentioned that all of your stories are personal, and so when you have an experience, I think my real question is, how do you choose among your experiences to develop into stories?
Oh, well, that's a different question.
Right.
What I do is this. When something happens, I ask myself, that's a pretty interesting phenomenon. That's a pretty interesting experience I've just had. What point can I make from it?
Okay.
So when something happens with the dog, if you read my blog, you find I'm always writing stories, writing articles, which is not essentially different from creating a speech, by the way. I'm always writing articles based on things the dogs teach me, and I make that kind of transfer. Now, in writing, you could stay with an example longer, but in a speech, I'm always asking myself, is there something about what just happened that can underscore a point that I want the audience to receive? And if so, then I'll test that out.
Okay. So you really work on developing the stories for a time before settling in with it.
Well, work is too strong a word.
Okay.
What I do is I get an idea and I start to practice it and I just tell it to people.
Okay.
And I see how it goes. And so I might be sitting at a board and I say, I've got a funny story, or I got an interesting thing that happened to me.
Okay.
Or I might be on the phone with someone and I just test them out and I see if it rings true and I see if I have the right approach to telling it. If that's work, then that's what I do, but it's not really much work. And I can tell pretty quickly whether it's going to be effective or not. And so, you know, 10 years ago I had a signature story I used to tell to open and close, and today I have different ones. They change. But the signature stories still exist, and I might include them in other places in my speaking.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Do you think anyone can be a competent speaker?
Yeah, with accent on the word competent. Not everyone can be a great speaker, but anyone can be a competent speaker if they do the following things. Number one, they have something to say that's of importance and of interest to others. Number two, they can deliver that those nuggets of importance and interest in an enlightening and satisfactory way. And number three, they can comport themselves on the stage with confidence and clarity. If you can do those three things, you can speak. I mean, people don't expect a whole lot more than that. And it's when you start delivering more than those simple things that people start to get amazed. But, it's really as simple as that.
So then follow on that question, what are the elements that make the speaker great?
Well, a great speaker is someone who can use humor and emotion to make points in a way that people internalize what's being said. Because, logic makes people think, emotion makes them act.
Mm-hmm.
So a great speaker connects with the audience emotionally, and that's why I use this self-denigrating humor, because people said, well, I've been there, that's happened to me. A great speaker is someone who uses the language so powerfully that people remember phrases. You know, they remember things like escape velocity.
Mm-hmm.
They remember things like if you think the water is deep, you tread water.
Mm-hmm.
And they capture that and take it home as a metaphor for remembering what they want to utilize about what you've said. Great speakers adapt to varying situations. I mean, I've had to speak under appalling conditions at times. Nothing's ever perfect in life. It's not perfect for the client. Why should it be for you? And so you adapt. And great speakers, I think, can talk extemporaneously. There are times when, I'm not saying to anyone don't prepare, but there are times when, for whatever the circumstances are, you have to depart from what you intended to deliver. Or there's a question that requires a different kind of response. Great speakers can speak well extemporaneously.
Okay. Thanks.
Alan, this is John again. You talk about staying in the moment. That was one of the things that you kind of emphasized here and also in other places. How do you stay in the moment while simultaneously thinking about where you need to go with your speech?
Well, I don't need to think about where I'm going to go with the speech. In other words, I'm delivering something, and then something happens, and I say, okay, I need to address this in the moment. And when I'm done, I just go back to where I was. Now, that might be something as easy as going back to the podium and saying, okay, where was I here? Well, I might say to the audience, I've been known to do this a lot of times, where was I? What was I talking about? There's a, I was watching Cliff Gorman, the actor, do Lenny Bruce, almost a one-man show, but it was about the comic Lenny Bruce's life. It was a very tough thing. And he went on these long riffs during it, which was characteristic of Lenny Bruce. And I was watching this off-Broadway down in the Village in New York. And he went on this long riff, and somebody in the audience did something, and he responded to what they did, as Lenny Bruce did, and he lost his place. In acting, it's called going up on your lines. And he had lost his place. And Cliff Gorman did a fascinating thing that I'd never forgotten and taught me a great deal. He turned to somebody in the audience, and he stayed in role as Lenny Bruce, and he said, where the hell was I? And the audience member said, well, you were talking about the cops. He said, right, the cops came in and accused me of having dope, and off he went again. And I do that with audiences all the time. You know, where was I? And some of you have been with me a lot have heard me say to somebody in the audience, listen, I want to talk about the cousin from Phoenix. Remind me when I'm done here. Or remind me of the three reasons for, and I'll trigger that with somebody, and they'll make a note, make sure they come back and get me back on target again.
Okay. Hey, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to, when you have a speech outline, you want to make your 4 points or your 8 points or however many points you want to make. You want to make sure you cover everything that you want to cover. And so I know when I'm up on stage, that preoccupies my mind. And I think that's why I get a little bit thrown if somebody asks me a question. I might get a little unstabilized,
And that's because you're being speaker-centered, not audience-centered. You're consumed with finishing the speech and hitting 4 points. I mean, if you think about it, John, the audience is better off if you hit 2 points that are relevant for them rather than 4 points you put in your outline.
Okay.
And so, I mean, if I had told the audience, look, I have 6 points I'm going to cover, and by the end of it, I only covered four, and so I said, didn't you say you had 6 points? I said, yeah, you know, but the conversation was so incredible that I think what we covered was much more important. But, you know, if you go to my website, or I'll send you a handout or drop me an email, and I'll send you a list of all 6 points. But, you know, it's really not a question of covering everything you've got. It's a question of helping the audience. The only thing that you need to keep in mind at all times is you must finish on time. You must finish on time, because nobody has ever objected to a speaker who finished 10 minutes early. Nobody's ever objected to that. But if you finish 5 minutes late, people will start forgetting everything you said, because they say, when is he going to finish? I got a bus to catch. I wanted to get the hell out of here. I have to make a phone call. Never, ever, ever go overtime.
Alan?
All right, as we have about 5 minutes left, I don't want to go overtime.
Yeah, I have a question for Alan. Alan, in terms of, you know, we talked about Q&A, do you do Q&A, do your whole speech and finish and close and then do Q&A, or do you do Q&A and then you close?
No, never do Q&A at the end. You do Q&A about thirds of the way through. Because okay. If you do it earlier than that, people haven't heard enough to ask questions about. But by two-thirds of the way through, you can judge by the questions, and somebody asked me this question earlier, how well the audience has been with you, what's on their mind, and you can adjust the remainder of your speech. But you always want to finish with a close, and so Q&A has to finish before your close. You never want to finish on a question and answer. You want to go into your close, call for action, and then end it professionally, on time. The good thing about Q&A is you can adjust it. So, you know, if let's say you have 15 minutes left and you ask for questions, and you get a lot of questions, after 10 minutes, you can say, I need to stop now. As you know, your close is 5 minutes. I need to stop now and summarize so I don't go overtime, but thank you for these questions. On the other hand, if you get very few questions, then you know you have to go back to your prepared material. So you should always have enough material to fill up the entire time period. Don't depend on Q&A. I'd also tell you this. When you get a question, there are three things you have to do. Repeat it. So you say the question is. That way everybody can hear it again. You have time to think. Then you respond to it. You give your answer. And then you review. And you say to the individual, did I answer your question? Or, did you understand my answer? How would you apply this, which is a testing question? But you always want to repeat, respond, and review. If you have a hostile questioner who's asking you a hostile question, you repeat, respond, but don't review, and you say, I think we have another question over here. And that's how you get away from a hostile questioner.
What if you get a question that you don't know the answer to?
Well, what do you think? You say, you know, that's a great question. I don't know the answer, but I'll tell you what. If you stop and see me after I'm done, give me your email address. I'll research it and I'll get back to you. I mean, what else can you possibly say?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, all eyes are on you, right? So you're supposed to be the expert. And so,
you're supposed to be honest. And if somebody asks me a question I don't know, I'm going to say, that's a good question. I just don't know. And I remember I read a book on prehistoric sea creatures. These huge reptiles. They used to live in the ocean. And since they were reptiles, they were air breathers, you know. They weren't fish, they were reptiles. And so they would hunt in the ocean, live in the ocean, but they had to breathe air. It was a fascinating book. I read things like this. So it was a fascinating book. And the guy talked about some of them would lay on the ocean bottom, and some of them would sort of patrol halfway down. Some of them would dive. And so by the end of the book, I'm wondering, how long could they hold their breath? Because I know a sperm whale today can hold its breath for over an hour, and it goes down and fights with a giant squid. It's a hell of a way to make a living. You know, it just fascinates me. You dive down a half a mile, you hold your breath, and you fight a giant squid. It's a hell of a way to feed the family. And so I wrote to the author, and I said, and I loved your book, I said, but tell me something. How long could these things hold their breath? And he wrote back to me. It's about 2 weeks later. He said, God, that's a great question. He said, it never occurred to me. And I thought this is a renowned scientist. He probably knows more about sea reptiles, you know, prehistoric sea reptiles. Anybody else on Earth? He doesn't know. I thought that was great. So sometimes you just don't know.
That's funny. Well, on that, I think we're just about out of time. On that, we're going to go ahead and close it up. Thanks a lot, Alan. I really, really appreciate it. I think I got a lot out of it. I hope everybody else got out of it, too. And I can't thank you enough for taking some time with us in order to answer our questions.
My pleasure. Everybody, enjoy, stay well, and I'll talk to you soon.